It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we're in conversation with Brown County's CEO and chief elected official to get a better grasp of what counties are facing as they put together 2023 budget proposals. Brown County's $353 million spending plan is expected to go before the county's board toward the end of the month. Join in on sales tax revenue, property tax millage, federal stimulus dollars, and shared revenue as your county puts together a budget. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Troy Streckenbach is the Brown County executive. Troy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you, Kate. I appreciate the opportunity. It's great to be here.
Good. So you're proposing to cut property taxes by more than 10%. How can your county afford to cut property taxes while still maintaining the level of services?
You know, so we in 2017 introduced a debt reduction tax relief infrastructure plan where we essentially had set the stage for the county to enact a sales tax with the ultimate goal of eliminating debt, reducing our debt levy payment, and ultimately reducing our overall tax rate. And so what we've seen over the course of the last, since 2017, we've eliminated roughly $80 million of debt. We are right now experiencing a 40-cent reduction in our overall tax rate. We've doubled roughly our investment in infrastructure. So we're fixing our roads. We're doing things that have been kind of kicked down the road as far as the, you know, preventive maintenance and maintaining our assets. And so overall, we've been able to kind of plan out this, and it's kind of working the way we anticipated. Of course, net new construction overall is not keeping up with inflation. So you are seeing counties throughout the state of Wisconsin struggling to maintain the level of services. And all of us counties are, every year going through that budget and, you know, making decisions about what should maintain, what's a good return on investment in regards to the property taxpayers and the constituents overall, and then trying to figure out how do we, continue to provide a good level of service for the residents of Brown County.
How much of your formula there has been boosted by federal economic stimulus money?
So Brown County received roughly $51 million in ARPA dollars. And the county board, through its oversight committees, have allocated roughly $23 million of those. And the remaining balance has been identified and will be allocated over the course of the next 2 years. Some of that is going to issues such as retention of staff and one-time payments. We, like every county, we are experiencing difficulties in retaining both 911 telecommunicators, our correctional officers, our nurses in our psychiatric hospital. And so we're looking at ways that we can utilize some of those dollars to maintain and retain. And at the same time, we're taking those dollars and investing them in flooding around the area. We're investing in our tourism center. We're investing in things that will help our economy come back since the pandemic.
One more time, though, circling back to property taxes, as we see property values have been soaring everywhere. I mean, the latest U.S. affordability report says the portion of average wages needed for monthly home payments has risen at the fastest rate since 2000. What do the rising values mean for your tax collections?
Well, of course, the overall assessed value of the county in the past 10 years has gone up by $10 billion for Brown County. So that net new construction and value, of course, helps the current property taxpayers, but it also brings in more value and revenue for governments to provide the services for growing economies. Now, where you have places in the state that perhaps are not seeing that same type of growth, And then, of course, the inflationary factors, they are certainly feeling the stress of the two not meeting up in terms of providing services with the needed revenues to support. So Brown County has experienced growth in the past decade and continue to grow this year. And that's helped, but the inflationary costs are higher than what the net new construction, the value of the assessed values in terms of helping the overall county with its services.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Brown County's 2023 budget proposal with Troy Streckenbach, who's Brown County executive. You can join in on your county budget proposal, questions you have about Brown County's formula and how it sees it balancing its budget going forward and priorities, 800-642-1234. You mentioned, Troy, staffing crunch. And in August, the Wisconsin Policy Forum reported state and local government employees are retiring or leaving the workforce at the fastest rate since at least 2002. How can counties maintain adequate staffing for services?
Yeah, so if we look at our core mandated services, such as for us, you know, we obviously manage and oversee the sheriff's office, court systems. A lot of those dollars come from the state. So, you know, right now we're having a very good discussion through the Wisconsin Counties Association and a delegation that is working on trying to address the shared revenue dollars for maintaining some of our mandated services. And of course, as a county, we are of course looking at just what can we do within our own budgetary aspects to maintain. And sometimes that requires us to make some tough decisions, but it's no different than if someone was at their home and they had to make some tough decisions about how do we, you know, maintain one asset over another. And so for the county, we of course are looking at, you know, our correctional officers, we're looking at our 911 operators, we're looking at our nursing staffing, and just our general employees. And we are coming up with ways for us to address that. But it's not been easy. And of course, we are making some tough decisions.
You bring up shared revenue, and the state revenue department last month provided the estimated shared revenue amounts local governments will receive in 2023. Just a couple examples here. Green Bay's estimate, $17.6 million. Brown County, nearly $3.4 million. Is shared revenue a fair share with the state? What is your perspective?
So, you know, if you look at the counties, you know, just what county government does, of course, we're a lot different than municipalities. If you just kind of look at some of the increases of, you know, abuse and neglect cases, elder abuse, food share, Medicaid, you know, what it costs us to send a child to Lincoln Hills, you know, the costs are associated with a lot of the things that are kind of mandated aspects of the extension of the state. That we operate as county governments, those costs have gone up quite considerably. But if you look at the last, since 2005, roughly, shared revenue has dropped by roughly 9%. And so while our cost of operating county government has gone up, the shared revenue hasn't maintained at a level. And so we are struggling to do a lot of the state's work. And of course, we're trying to communicate that through the Wisconsin Counties Association with both the governor's office and the state legislature to try to find a way for us to address that challenge for us to fund a lot of the mandated services that the counties operate.
Brown County's chief elected official Troy Streckenbach with us has a proposed budget for next year that will increase spending but cut the county's portion of property taxes. We're working through the bits and pieces here. Join in the situation with your county budget for 2023. Tough choices your community is grappling with. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we examine the budget picture for Brown County in northeastern Wisconsin, it's a jumping off point, if you will, on what county budget discussions look like around our state. Brown County's CEO, Troy Streckenbach, has held the job for 11 years, and this budget proposal is a 13% increase from the 2022 budget. Still time to talk about county budget forecasts, 800-642-1234. And Troy Streckenbach stays with us. Let's bring on a call now. Jeff is here from Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. My concern is that, you know, so many of us are going through these same budget issues in counties, municipalities all over the state. And it seems like the go-to solution is always, well, increased development. And, you know, so many of us in the community where I live, we're seeing the same thing, but we're very concerned that all this development is just going to mean, you know, more traffic, more roads, environmental issues. And isn't that just going to increase cost in the long run? And furthermore, developable land is a finite resource. What happens when we run out of land to develop? We're not going to have that tool to turn to anymore. So those are my concerns. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for bringing that up, that tension, Troy, with more development, more infrastructure. What do you make of that?
Well, Jeff brings up a really good point in terms of the way the state funds both, you know, county and local governments. We're very heavily reliant on property taxes. And so you see municipalities, counties throughout the state of Wisconsin wanting to see that growth to take place in their communities to help develop or provide for the revenues and the services that residents, you know, hope to expect. You know, when we think about taking trash out or having, you know, police services, you know, those general parks, sidewalks, all of those things cost money. And in order for us to be able to provide a lot of those services to residents, we need the types of revenues to support those type of things. So, you know, the state of Wisconsin is one of the highest property tax reliant states in the United States, and our diversification of revenue, such as a sales tax or income tax, is we're somewhat lopsided. And so hopefully through the state over time, there will be more discussions about how to perhaps create more of a diversification of the revenue streams that that flow through to counties and municipalities to help maybe perhaps lessen the pressure on local communities to fund services that do not rely on the development aspect. But as of right now, that is the main source for local governments to generate the revenue necessary to fund the services that their residents seek.
As Jeff brings up development and infrastructure, just looking at your capital projects, your county listed nearly $750 million in capital construction it hoped to complete over the next 6 years. So how do you go about deciding what upgrades are essential with services for residents?
So, you know, obviously from the county's perspective, we're looking at infrastructure such as, you know, our, you know, things that we can help municipalities and be prepared for the types of growth that they're seeking. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is make sure that Brown County is a sought after community for both families and businesses to want to locate. So one, we're very conscious of our overall taxes. And of course, then we're also concerned about having the appropriate infrastructure, community amenities that will attract businesses and families to this area. So when we think about infrastructure, we're thinking interchanges off the interstates. We just recently celebrated the ribbon cutting of a VV-29 interchange in our northern part of the county, which was a huge support for the villages of Hobart, the villages of Howard. It helped public safety for a school district, but ultimately is going to create opportunities for economic development. And then yesterday we just announced in support with the Secretary of Craig Thompson through the Evers administration that they're going to be providing $50 million in this upcoming budget to help us build a bridge that's been talked about since the 60s. And so this is going to help our southern part of our county, but that total project from one end to the other is roughly a $175 million project. And so infrastructure is critical for us to be able to be competitive. And it also is important for us to make sure that we're maintaining our roads for good commerce.
Talking about Brown County's 2023 budget proposal with Troy Streckenbach, a Brown County executive. You can join in on county budget proposals, what you see for next year, 800-642-1234. Let's turn from infrastructure to young people, schools. Your budget is really asking the county library system to address equity gaps in reading proficiency, talking about, you know, one third of third graders in the county can read proficiently. What type of dollars do you want for libraries to change services?
So as you know, Brown counties are not necessarily responsible for the ultimate outcomes of our youth. You know, that really is a shared responsibility through parents and the school districts. What the county and through the leadership of our executive director of our consolidated library system, Sarah Sugden, basically saw that our reading proficiency for third graders was on a five-year decline, and that's just simply not acceptable. We as a county want to see what we can do in our spaces that we can help be part of the solution. When we think about our assets between the nine libraries that we oversee throughout Brown County, and the amount of children who are coming through, our library director wanted to see if there's a way for us to participate and offer services both for children, for parents, to see if there's ways for us to help, that child gain that reading proficiency, which we all understand is critical at that point in time in order for that child to be successful later on in high school and ultimately graduate. And so from our perspective, our library director wanted to step into this space, be more vocal about it. And we partnered up with a nonprofit called Achieve Brown County, which is their ultimate goal is to address that gap and the graduation rates in Brown County. And so we're hoping that through our Brown County library system, through our park system, through our Neville Public Museum, some of the assets that are Extension Brown County, all these areas have points in contact with children, and we're gonna make a high focus on what we can do to help change that declining trend and see it grow. We're one piece of the puzzle.
And now another piece here, moving to the opioid crisis and what you want to see out of Brown County Public Health. Explain in terms of how you want to use pharmaceutical settlement dollars for Brown County Public Health and how you want to address the opioid crisis in your county.
Yeah, so we're one of a few counties in the state of Wisconsin that has declared fentanyl as a public health crisis. I believe Waukesha County has done it as well. It's pretty alarming that the drug overdoses that are happening in Brown County, 79% of them this last year had fentanyl in them. We intend on creating a campaign around awareness, recovery, and action to address One, the long-term impacts of opiates, but more importantly, to make people aware, our youth, our parents, about the dangers around fentanyl. And it's kind of concerning. It's actually very scary to consider that the right now, the bad people are making counterfeit pills that would look like something that you would normally take for, managing an issue. And they're actually counterfeit as fentanyl, and people are dying from it. And so we are going to take those dollars and use some of those dollars to help us address a number of issues within Brown County, but also really look at how can we join forces with other counties in the state so that we can have a wider discussion. So that, because we understand that this doesn't have a border, this is not a county, this is it's the whole state, it's the whole country that's really struggling with this.
Troy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to coming back.
Troy Streckenbach is Brown County Executive. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a preview of a new WPR podcast launching today called WPR Reports Uprooted, which explores the lives of Cubans in Wisconsin.
Imagine you're a 16-year-old kid thousands of miles from home. You've just stepped off a plane in Wisconsin. For the next few months, you'll be living at an army base. There are strangers, people who don't speak your language. It feels like you're living in prison. Your whole world has been uprooted. You think you're alone, far from family and friends, when suddenly you discover your father, who you've barely had a relationship with, is also at this military base in Wisconsin. This was the reality for Armando Rodriguez, who left his barracks at Fort McCoy daily to meet with his father, Guillermo Rodriguez.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. And we spent about a month and some like that.
Armando and Guillermo are from Cuba and had to live at Fort McCoy until they found a home in the United States. They were here in Sparta, Wisconsin, because of the Mariel boatlift. For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders and let its residents leave for the U.S. during the height of the Cold War. Almost 125,000 Cubans fled the island and landed in South Florida by boat.
She says more craft are expected to make the journey in what could build into a Dunkirk-like evacuation.
Because of that, the president yesterday declared a state of emergency in southern Florida.
There's a hopeful feeling that they will be allowed to stay in this country and to find jobs.
Many refugees left their homeland to find a better opportunity or escape Fidel Castro's communist government. Some wanted to be reunited with family. Others were plucked from jail and pushed onto boats.
We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
Armando was one of the nearly 15,000 people sent to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin before he found a home. Most of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin left the area after connecting with family or finding sponsors. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. Now, 42 years later, many of the refugees want to visit Cuba. People like Armando want to go just one more time. But they can't.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I am in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
His friends in Wisconsin feel the same.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
The immigration, you know, give us a second chance. Why can those Cubans get a second chance?
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because I was lucky. I never commit a crime. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I tried to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
I'm Maureen McCollum, and this is Uprooted, a new podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll hear from Cuban Wisconsinites who arrived here more than 40 years ago. These are the unheard voices behind the headlines. What were their lives like in Cuba? What was the journey like across the sea? What has life been like in Wisconsin? And after 40 years, where do they go from here? Subscribe to Uprooted wherever you get your podcasts, and you can see more at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now time to check in on the Packers and the world of sports. Quarterback Aaron Rodgers wasn't down with the locker room talk after falling to the New York Giants Sunday, telling reporters after the loss.
I'm a firm believer in the power of words and manifestation, and we got to check ourselves on that because talking about that is not, that's not winning football.
Joining in on the Pack and what you're a firm believer in with a 3-2 record heading into Sunday's matchup with the Jets, 800-642-1234. Justice Cleveland is here, sports director at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire. Justice, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, before we get to the Pack, let's talk about these concussion rules. The league making this mid-season change in rules and the Players Association agreeing to update the concussion protocol. What does this decision mean?
I think it means we're not going to have any more incidences like we had with the Dolphins 2 weeks ago, where Tua gets taken down the week before. Mm-hmm. And then comes out and get, you know, on national TV in a spotlight, has one of the worst concussions, I think, injuries that you've ever seen in the NFL. That it's a horrible look for the league. So it's good that they're making this adjustment during the season, but obviously you would have liked to have seen it before the season. So something like that just doesn't happen.
How long are NFL players out for a concussion? What does the new protocol say?
Well, generally, it's for a week. You know, it's a week. They're put in protocol and they're monitored. They have to pass the baseline tests. I think what they're trying to do now is just make it a little more strict to make sure that people can't get out early. I think that with Tua, that was what a lot of people said. They couldn't believe after he stumbled and fell to the ground a week before that he was back on the field on a Thursday night game. So I think the big thing is they're trying to tighten things up and just making sure that something like that can't happen again.
You see the term ataxia in the protocols, that if they show signs of ataxia, they're prohibited from returning to a game. You talked about staggering there. What are the symptoms being used by the NFL?
Oh boy. Not being a medical expert per se, but yeah, I think you if you see anything that shows that there could be something going on with the brain, that you need to, you know, it, and I think you'd have to have that outside independent person being able to make that call. So, because the players are going to try to get out on the field, and that's in their mentality is that they want to go out there and play. But you need to have somebody in there that if they see anything that says, okay, no, something cognitive is being disrupted here, he's got to be out. So, yeah, I think it's one of those things where they, again, are just trying to make sure that if there's anything, and I think the last couple of weeks we've actually seen it, where they've taken guys out and said, no, you're not going back in. I believe Teddy Bridgewater, who's also the quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, didn't show any signs, but from what they saw on the play, they held him out the rest of the game. So I'm okay with that. I mean, you need to be with an overabundance of caution because of the history that comes with concussions in the NFL.
One more thing I want to run by you here, Justice. The roughing the passer penalty is coming under greater scrutiny as to how that's being used to protect quarterbacks from these bad hits. What do you make of how this penalty is being used and when it's being called?
And that's one of the toughest things. Obviously, you want to protect these quarterbacks, and you don't want to see anybody have another situation like you had with Tua in Miami, but they've also, it's such a, the interpretation of the rules, and we saw it twice last week, Tom Brady on one where it didn't even look like there was anything really to call there. And then you have another one on Monday Night Football where you have a ball being fumbled and a player trying to get that ball, but also landing on top of the quarterback and getting a penalty for that. So it is such a slippery slope between protecting and still having the integrity of the game. So I think it would be something that, and I've heard this mentioned many times, something that could be up for review, something you could take a look at after it's happened and say, okay, no, that's not roughing. And that way you're not just calling this penalty and not really having a second chance to look at what ended up happening. I know the Packers a few years ago now, it was when Clay Matthews was playing for him, he had three or four of those penalties called in the first 2 weeks where they said that he was landing with his full weight on the quarterback. And you'd look at a review and you'd be like, what's he supposed to do? You got a 250-pound person whose job it is to jump on top of another person, but then is not supposed to jump with full force. Football being a violent sport, it's such a slippery slope between safety and that inherent violence.
And a call that can change the course of the game and the outcome. Well, let's turn to Packers, falling to the New York Giants in London. And Aaron Rodgers talked about conversations happening in the locker room. He said it revolved around players saying they could potentially lose to the Jets this Sunday.
I'm not going to address prospects of losing up here, other than we just lost this game. Offensively, we haven't put two halves together. There's a lot that factors into that. You know, everything from calls to execution, to the momentum, to defensive stops.
Okay, so how do you move on to the Jets and be in that mindset that Rodgers wants the guys to be in?
Well, what they have to look at is that they were basically embarrassed in London there in the second half against the Giants. And I think you got to look at it as kind of like a wake-up call. And I think that game, that second half of that game will be for the team. So I think it's one of those like, okay, we're a good team, but I think they've been resting on their laurels a little too much and not stepping up, and teams are adjusting. And they didn't really adjust in that game. So they should be a very motivated team coming into Sunday. It's another opponent that on paper they have much more going for them than they do the Jets. But as they always say, and I go into cliche, games aren't played on paper. So, but yeah, I mean, this is a team that has a lot of young players in it, had a lot of hype coming into the season. And yes, they're 3-2, but they've had a lot of lulls in their games that have allowed teams to come back. So they've won ugly, and last week they lost ugly.
Lisa from Milwaukee called and couldn't stay and said that players are concerned about losing their jobs, so they continue to play even through injuries. That has consequences, though, Justice.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I think that is a big part of it, too, is these guys know that there's only, you have 53 spots on each team. Mm-hmm. So your chances of being in this league are slim. Once you get one of those jobs, holding on to one of those jobs is slim too. So I think, yeah, you got to protect the players from themselves. And I think that's what the league's trying to do, is to make sure that you don't have these guys going out there and doing more damage to their bodies.
We have WEAU TV sports director Justice Cleveland, our guide to the PAC, college football standings, and more coming up. Join in with your takeaways, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our wide world of Wisconsin sports conversation and what sports director Justice Cleveland of WEAU-TV is paying attention to at this point in seasons. Still time for your thoughts as a fan, 800-642-1234. Justice stays with us. Okay, we turn to the Badgers and your hot take on the firing of Paul Chryst after a 2-3 start to the season, the program's first firing since 89. Why was Paul Chryst fired?
In the short, they weren't making the progress that they wanted to see. I think those two losses to Ohio State, a top three team, and then Illinois, I think the Illinois one probably hurt even more because it was Brett Bielema coming back and a former coach that you needed to bounce back from a bad loss to Ohio State. Unfortunately, they went and had an even maybe worse loss to Illinois. So I think that, and I'm sure the boosters were making noise after that. And in college football, the boosters tend to wield a lot of power. So I think that ended up hurting it. And the team offensively had struggled last year, went and made changes, and arguably was worse this year. So I think there was just a lot of factors that were checking the boxes there, and they're like, okay, maybe it's time to make a change. And they had a guy in Jim Leonard who was in-house that's been up for jobs in the NFL and in college and has chose to stay with the Badgers. And I think it was, okay, well, we have him here. Let's give him a chance to see what he can do.
Well, let's hear a bit of Leonard at the press conference after the Northwestern game.
The emotions early in the week were hard to handle for some guys and the coaches. And for us to rally and be able to compartmentalize that and get the work done that we needed to get done, focus on the improvement when we needed to do that, and then handle the emotions, you know, when allowed.
So, you know, he's talking about having the guys compartmentalize their emotions. And he said, you know, the firing hurt a lot of guys. And Leonard was like, there's really little I can do in that moment to say in that moment. So what does it mean for the player's mentality here?
Oh, it's got to be very tough because this is the guy who brought you in. And even, you know, Jim Leonard said it in his opening press conference when he was announced that, you know, Paul Chryst took a chance on him with no experience to bring him into his coaching staff and had his support. So I think he was very emotional in that moment, too. I think Paul Chryst's a guy who's very much liked by a lot of people. And I think it was hard for that because, you know, he goes around as being this, you know, really nice guy. But unfortunately, that's the reality of sports, is that if you're not winning, you can be gone the next day. So I think for a lot of it was maybe a reality check for not just, you know, Jim Leonard, but those players as well, just how quick things can change in the world of sports.
How will coaching change, you know, affect what we see on the field? I mean, you got, you know, Badgers at Michigan State Saturday. What do you expect?
I mean, this is another game that they should be able to come out with a win. I mean, it's tough going on the road, but looking just at last week's game, they really showed it was a different team that seemed a little looser, which sometimes in sports is a good thing. You don't want to get too loose, but I think the way they played, the emotion that they were showing, that they're a little, it's a different team mentality maybe with Jim Leonard at the helm. And I think a lot of times you'll see that with the first week when there's a coaching change because guys are very emotional, as they were talking about before. If they can sustain it, we'll see here at Michigan State. Michigan State's not having a great season as well. So, again, it's a win. It's a game that the Badgers look like they should be able to win.
Okay. Well, I'm so eager here. I want to move to all the way to the Bucks and, you know, lost last night against the Bulls. What are your takeaways from that game and as we head into the season for Giannis and company?
I mean, preseason. I don't know how much you want to take too much away from it. That's
I
my
like
look.
That mentality.
They're 0-4. I don't see them being 0-4 to the start of the regular season. So I think it's just, you know, getting a chance to get these guys out there. And really, I mean, the Bucks, it was all bench guys that played in that game. Honestly, I mean, there's not a guy who was a starter that played yesterday. So I think that's one of the big things. Whereas the Bulls were playing their starters, and though, hey, you know what? I'll give credit. If the bench guys can score over 100 points against the Bulls starters, that's not bad. So,
okay.
No, I think this is a team that's going to it's going to battle for a chance for that Eastern Conference title. They bring back a lot of that same core that they have had the last few years, obviously, with the championship.
The big three, yeah, Giannis right. And Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday. I mean, will they have those big three on the floor when it matters? You know, that is the question.
Yeah, and I think last year in the playoffs, we saw the biggest thing is when Chris Middleton was gone. They had a tough time adjusting and throwing guys in there to take his spot because he's that good of a player. I don't think he gets as much credit for how good of a player he is. He's an all-star player. And when you lose something like that in the playoffs, in the midst of, you know, the most competitive games you're going to play all season, it's going to make a huge difference. So if everybody can stay healthy, I mean, the potential's there to be back where they were 2 years ago. But again, health is always the biggest factor in a lot of sports. And obviously in the NBA, it is too.
Giannis said it's nice to have the same people around, people that you've won a championship with. So feels like he's in good company.
Yeah, and you don't see that a whole lot in the NBA, honestly. I mean, for guys are a lot of the time on the move, but I think that's credit to the Bucks is that they've created this atmosphere where these guys want to stay, where a guy like George Hill, who was gone, comes back because he wants to play there. You have Brook Lopez, who you know, comes back from major back surgery, but still wants to play. So I think, and Bobby Portis comes back too. So to me, that's huge. That shows that you're doing something well, not only on the floor, but with the culture of your team.
Justice Cleveland here giving us a roundup on football, basketball. We'll move to baseball and the Brewers next. Sports director at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. So the Brewers missed the playoffs despite that 10th inning win against the Arizona Diamondbacks. Let's listen at that final play.
Line drive, base hit, ball game. Hunter Renfroe delivers for the Brewers. A 6-5 walk-off victory here tonight against the Arizona Diamondbacks.
So the Brewers beat the Diamondbacks. Why did the team miss the playoffs?
I think it comes down to hitting. They had enough pitching. They had some really good pitching, starting pitching, I will say. Hitting and relief pitching, though, is where at times they struggled. They were reliant on the home run ball. So if they weren't getting home runs, they weren't really scoring runs. And the second half, the bullpen just wasn't the same bullpen they had in the first half. Obviously, people can point to the Josh Hader trade. And it's not like Josh Hader went to San Diego and had the greatest second half either. So I don't know how much that even would have factored into it. It was just the middle relief and just, you know, losing those close games that ended up costing them a chance to be in the playoffs. You win four more games, you win two more games, you're in the playoffs. So 86 and 76 isn't anything bad, but it's just one of those where they just didn't have enough horses as it comes to hitting to I think, overturn all the close losses.
In our final moments left here, Brewers, they won't be back together until spring training in 4 months or so, but the core members of the team will be there. And what difference do you think that will make for next season?
I think it'll be big. I think we saw a little bit of Christian Yelich coming back to form in the second half of the season. I do think they need to add somebody else in there with the rule changes that are coming without the shift and stuff, that somebody who can make contact and hit for a higher average than 250, which was like the highest on the Brewers.
Okay, so we'll be watching for that. Justice, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was always fun. It always is.
Justice Cleveland is a sports director at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire. As we do the roundup of Wisconsin sports, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.